Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for August 2009. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. This month we deal with two diverse topics, a European perspective on liability for third-party content on the Internet, and criticisms of an attempt at a fix for patent claim construction issues in the United States. It's easy enough to get yourself in trouble on the Internet, but the problems are compounded once you start posting other people's content. My first guest is Neeri Shanmuganathan, who is the head of the Trademarks, Copyright, and Media Group of Taylor Wessing in London, England. He's a co-author of a recent Taylor Wessing publication entitled Liability of Online Publishers for User-Generated Content. The report deals with the law in England, France, and Germany. I spoke with Neeri from his office in London, England. Good morning, Neeri.
Good morning.
Neeri, what is it about user-generated content that makes life so complicated for Internet hosts?
I think the problem that we're finding in Europe is that the law is very grey. Although there's meant to be harmonization of the law and how it deals with user-generated content, it's been interpreted in a different way in different jurisdictions. And obviously, as a host, you haven't got any control over user-generated content, but you might find yourself liable for what third parties say in a blog or on a message board or in relation to things that they might upload onto a website that you're hosting. So it's a real area of potential risk and liability for hosts. And because the law is so grey, everyone is very concerned about it.
Based on the paper that you and your colleagues have written, the question that occurs to me is to moderate the content or not to moderate. What are the considerations, pro and con?
Well, that is a very good question. It's a question that we wrestle with all the time when we're advising our clients on this issue. If you look at the relevant legislation, which is the European Directive on Electronic Commerce, and also the domestic legislation in the UK, which is the Defamation Act 1996, those two bits of legislation dictate us to believe that actually it is better not to moderate content than to moderate, because if you don't moderate content, you're more likely to fall within the defenses in those two bits of legislation. Because the two bits of legislation talk about not having actual knowledge of the bit of user-generated content that is the subject of the complaint. Now, obviously, if you moderate something, then you're going to have knowledge of it, and you won't be able to avail yourself of these defenses. Now, the argument against that, i.e., when should you moderate, is twofold. Firstly, when you have a commercial publisher that is hosting on its website user-generated content, often the commercial publisher, for editorial reasons, wants to have control over what's on its website. And for that reason, it might want to either pre-moderate content before it goes up or post-moderate content after it's gone up, just to make sure that what is being written on a website or what is being uploaded on a website is consistent with their editorial policies. The other consideration is that if you pre-vet or if you post-vet content, it's less likely, if you can do it properly, that you'll receive a complaint in the first place. So those are two good reasons to moderate. On balance, we are advising our clients generally not to moderate, because we're finding that the amount of user-generated content that are on our clients' website means that the moderation exercise can't take place with the appropriate level of care and standard that we would hope. In the majority, we would say that moderation is the best way to proceed. Not to moderate is the best way to proceed.
In the case of the European Directive on Electronic Commerce, I understand that there's a two-part defense to it. One is that you don't have actual knowledge of the illegal activity or information. And the other is that if you immediately take down content complained of. And could you explain what sort of process you should set up in order to react to that
and make use of those defenses?
Yes, and let's presume that you're not moderating your content, because if you obviously moderate your content, then you're going to have actual knowledge and therefore go no further with the European defense. But assuming that you're not moderating, you don't have actual knowledge of whatever it is that's being complained about, and then you're put on notice of the complaint, then the question is, what do you do then? Now, what we're advising our clients is to have a report this post facility, so that in the first place you get properly informed when a complaint comes in. What has sometimes happened with our clients is that a complaint has come in and it gets lost on someone's desk or in the office somewhere. So in those circumstances, you'll be taken by the court to have notice. Yet, if you only discover the complaint 2 or 3 months down the line and haven't done anything about it, you fall foul of the second part of the test, which is, after you're put on notice, have you taken the particular bit of content down? So the first part of what we advise is to have a proper report this post facility, so that if someone has a complaint, it goes to someone who can deal with it quickly. The second thing we advise is that, because when you're put on notice of a complaint, you have knowledge of the complaint, you take down the offending material straight away. Now that might seem like a drastic step to take, because I know that in North America, for example, there are much broader safe harbor provisions. But because of the way the legislation works here, unfortunately, what clients have to do is to take it down to make sure that they can rely on this defense. Now, after further investigation, they might find that they can put it back up. But in the initial instance, we advise our clients to have a notice and takedown procedure whereby they take down the offending material as soon as possible.
I understand, again, from your article that in a couple of other European jurisdictions, Germany and France, for instance, hosts have to do more than simply take the material down. They have to be more vigilant. Could you explain that briefly?
Yes. In Germany, for example, there was a case involving eBay. And in that case, not only did the court believe that the steps should be taken to take down the particular offending material, it was a case involving a trademark infringement case involving Rolex, but also the court said that there was a duty of care on eBay to take reasonable measures to prevent similar infringements by the same or other users. Now, query what that means, but what it certainly meant is that they would have to have searches, both automatic and manual, in place to make sure there weren't similar Rolex infringements. But what is worrying about this case is to what extent there has to be monitoring of similar infringements. So let's say we had another brand owner whose mark was being infringed. Should you be monitoring other brand owners in the same way? That's what happened in that case. Also in France, there was a case involving eBay and LVMH, who sued eBay for trademark infringement. And in that case, they held that eBay couldn't rely on the hosting exemption because it was a broker. So it did more than host the particular material on its site. It was actually encouraging the material to be put on there and therefore was held to be a broker. So different European jurisdictions have been interpreting the directive in different ways. But certainly in the UK, we believe that if you take down the material, that will be the end of it. But in other European jurisdictions, it looks like more has to be done.
Third-party content can sometimes be appropriated, and user-generated content can become your own if you're a hoster. What can a host do to minimize its exposure to that sort of liability?
This is a particular problem when you have a commercial publisher who is hosting content, third-party content, user-generated content on its website. So what we are recommending clients do is to make sure they don't brand the user-generated content under their own banner, and make clear that there is a separation between their own content and third-party content. So having a physical separation on the website, having notices making clear that it's separate and it's not their content. Also, I think that if you have what you call strollers, so these are people that go around encouraging people to post particular types of comments in relation to a particular content, then a court could say that what follows from that stroller trying to encourage comment is the responsibility of the host. Also, if editorial staff, journalists, are contributing to a debate, a chain of on a message board, and as a result of that contribution, someone posts something, again, it could be held that the host, the commercial publisher, is hosting the site and is responsible for that. So what we're advising clients is to be very careful about using strollers and allowing editorial staff to contribute to debates. Now, there's been no cases in the UK about this, but there was a case in Germany about this where there was a site on which cooking recipes were posted. Each of those recipes were branded under the using the brand of the host. So it looked like it wasn't third-party content. It looked like it was the host's content. And in that case, it was held that the host was responsible for the content. So that's really an illustration of what I was saying before. There needs to be a physical separation and also there needs to be, you know, one has to be careful not to encourage a certain type of content. So I know that in the US there was a case involving an issue where the host had tick boxes where they asked people to post by ticking a particular comment, which categorized people who wanted to rent particular homes, so it categorized the characteristics. Now, that sort of thing, I think, in the UK, for example, and in other jurisdictions, if you had sort of check boxes of people's characteristics and asked third parties to tick particular characteristics, then you would be held responsible for whatever they did. So we advise our clients to just be very open in the questions they ask users in terms of what they want to post.
Now, the EU recently issued an intellectual property enforcement directive, I believe, in September of 2008, part of which required a host to provide information regarding the users who have posted content. What are the obligations of a host to provide information about who's posted under that directive?
Well, this is a very tricky issue because under our data protection laws, arguably if the host was to disclose the identity of the poster, they would be in breach of the Data Protection Act. At the same time, it's highly likely that a court will order disclosure of the poster's identity under something that's called a Norwich Pharmacall application. So that's an application made by the complainant for the disclosure of the identity of the poster against the host. So what we advise our clients to do is to take a neutral stance. So if they get a request for the revelation of the identity of the poster, they should write back and say that for data protection reasons they can't disclose the identity of the poster voluntarily, but they are happy to abide by any court order that the complainant obtains. And usually that has worked in every case that that we have dealt with.
Neri, can you provide some general advice to hosts who provide user-generated content?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first decision that has to be made is whether they should monitor third-party content or whether they shouldn't monitor third-party content. Whatever the client decides to do, it must make expressly clear to third-party users that that's what they're doing. As I've already said, we encourage our clients not to monitor unless there are strong editorial reasons to do so, and unless they have a procedure in place that if they do monitor, they can do it properly. It's also important to have a report this post facility and to take down any content that is the subject of a complaint clearly so that you can fall within the legislation, both the European and domestic legislation. It's also very important that the host has very express terms and conditions for users to make clear that users mustn't post anything on the website that is an infringement of an intellectual property right or that's defamatory or otherwise unlawful, and that they must click through those terms and conditions before they're allowed to post anything. The other thing is the physical separation of the site to make a distinction between their own content and the content of third parties, with appropriate notices to make that clear. I think if what it's all about is reasonable care must be taken by the host to make sure it's doing everything possible to minimize the risk of an infringing bit of content or a defamatory piece of content being posted on their site, and provided that the host can point to those procedures having been put in place, I think the host is putting itself in the best position possible to avail the defenses that are available in Europe.
Thank you very much for these insights, Neary.
No problem. Thank you very much.
There has recently been a very high reversal rate of patent claim constructions by the U.S. Court of Appeal for the Federal Circuit. This has created a revolving door of litigation, with retrials becoming more commonplace, wasting the resources of both the litigants and the courts. Amendments before Congress are attempting to fix this problem by allowing for interlocutory appeals from Markman claim construction hearing orders. A proposed section in the current Senate bill, 28 U.S.C. 1292c2, as proposed by Senator Leahy in April 2009, proposes a right of appeal for Markman orders but has two interesting features. First, the district court would have discretion as to whether to approve the application, where such an appeal may materially advance the ultimate determination of the litigation, or if the appeal will likely control the outcome of the case. Second, the Federal Circuit would have discretion to decline the appeal in extremely limited circumstances, only where certification permitting the appeal was clearly erroneous. These proposals are receiving heavy criticism from many patent practitioners who argue that the proposed solution may cause even greater problems than the one trying to be solved. Ed Reines is a partner in the Technology Litigation Practice Group in the Silicon Valley office of Weil, Gotshal & Manges, LLP. Ed has extensive experience in complex patent cases involving a wide range of high technologies and is nationally recognized as a leader in patent litigation. Along with his colleague Nathan Greenblatt, Ed recently wrote an article critical of the proposed amendments to the U.S. Patent Act. I spoke with Ed from his office in Silicon Valley.
Good afternoon, Ed.
Good afternoon.
Before we get to what's wrong with the proposed legislation, what's right about it?
Well, in general, the patent reform legislation has a number of modernizations, which I think could be beneficial, including moving to a first-to-file system, looking at potential damages reform. So there's a number of areas where I think there's the potential for improvement.
You say in your paper that failing to give the Federal Circuit discretion to decline an appeal from a Markman decision is misguided. How so?
The district courts and the Federal Circuit have different institutional roles and imperatives, and it's very easy for a district court to feel like the burden of a large litigation is better resolved or avoided through a shortcut to an appeal to the Federal Circuit. And so such a shortcut, if permitted, would throw the system out of whack. And the system is a system we've had for hundreds of years at this point in time. So I don't think we should tinker with the time-tested system that we have for appeals.
Would giving the Federal Circuit discretion as to whether to hear the appeal resolve all your concerns with a proposed section?
Good question, Don. But I think the problem there is that if you gave them discretion on a clearly erroneous standard, which is the current formulation, you then have satellite litigation in every case about whether an appeal was founded on clearly erroneous facts. And I just think all the satellite disputes about mid-case appeals is a distraction and an unwise use of resources.
you say in your paper that the actual problem with the current system is the fact that the Federal Circuit does a de novo review of claim construction since CIBOR. Could you explain what you mean?
Sure. So the Federal Circuit decided in the CIBOR case that all claim construction issues are purely legal and that district court judges should receive no deference to their claim constructions. Among other things, that's resulted in instability because basically what you have is a do-over at the federal get under the de novo standard. There's no deference given to what the trial judge did. So that has motivated parties, at least in some instances, to want to simply get to the Federal Circuit to have their do-over. If parties believed that on an appeal the district judge in appropriate cases would receive deference, then their expectation of a reversal and a do-over at the appeal court would be reduced, and frankly the need for expedited, you know, these shortcut appeals would be reduced substantially.
What would happen if the trial judge made a finding of fact as to what the words in the claim would have meant to those in the art, leaving the meaning of those claims in the context of the claim to be the question of law? Would the Federal Circuit have to give deference to a district court judge's findings of facts regarding the meanings of words in the industry?
Under CIBOR, the Federal Circuit has invoked a fiction that claim construction can never have a question of fact underlying it. I think the conventional and common wisdom in the bar is that that is fictional and that there are fact questions. But to address your question directly, the Federal Circuit would ignore what the district judge has stated as a fact question and would treat it as a legal question in review at de novo.
The Federal Circuit itself made some comments in Amgen and Roche that seemed to be welcoming the entertainment of a case to deal with CIBOR again. Do you expect that to occur?
That's inevitable. I mean, it's in some ways the most interesting area of Federal Circuit jurisprudence. That is, you have a majority of Federal Circuit judges that have gone on record as saying essentially CIBOR is wrong to some extent. And you have every major bar association group I'm aware of stating that CIBOR was wrongly decided. So everyone seems to agree that it's wrongly decided. Everybody's waiting patiently for the right vehicle for the Federal Circuit to address it. I think the problem is that the Federal Circuit doesn't know how the law would look if some aspects of claim construction were deemed factual and some were deemed legal in terms of where the line would be and how it would be administered. So I think the Federal Circuit is hesitating for that reason, but the clamor for CIBOR to be overturned will not go away.
You describe in your paper a court reversing its own claim construction order after further developments of the facts of the case. Is there a problem with Markman orders being made too early in the process before all the relevant factual evidence is in?
Another good question, Don. There are a million fact patterns. I'm sure in some cases that occurs. I think crystallizing the party's contention at an earlier point in the case is better than at a later point. So in general, I think there's been a consensus that earlier claim construction decision-making is better than later decision-making. But there are instances where circumstances warrant reconsideration of a claim construction over time, and nobody should be so hidebound that a mistake in construction isn't reconsidered within the further evolved record. And that does happen and should happen.
It seems like nobody is in favor of the particular legislation dealing with appeals from Markman hearings. Can that particular section be saved, or will it be saved?
My sense is that the section will go away. The tinkering with the final judgment rule is very dangerous. It's core to the American system of justice and our frankly system of appeals as well. And I don't think it's wise to move forward with it. I don't know how they could come up with something that would save it. Again, I think this proposed and so-called solution would just mask the real problem, which is if it will bring more stability to the system if CIBOR is reversed and district court claim constructions are received deference as appropriate. the gist of it is that some in the community feel like there's too many reversals of claim construction, so that there should just be an appeal right away to the Federal Circuit. And I've described why I think that there's so many problems with that. But the real true solution to the high reversal rate for claim constructions is by allowing district courts to have deference. And as I stated earlier, I think that's the direction that the legal system will move in.
So the legislation is trying to fix a symptom, but it's not fixing the disease itself.
Exactly. In fact, it's masking the problem, which is the lack of deference. I think it's just inevitable over time that CIBOR is going to be reversed, and we should be patient enough to wait for that.
Thank you very much for these insights, Ed.
My pleasure.
My guests for this podcast have been Neeri Shanmuganathan of Taylor Wessing in London, England, and Ed Reines of Weil Gotshal & Manges LLP in Redwood Shores, California. To access a copy of the Taylor Wessing Report on Liability of Online Publishers for User-Generated Content, for a copy of Ed Reines' paper on the proposed amendment to patent claim construction process in the United States, and for information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.